Bosley, brought to you by Barfoot and Thompson.
On the show today, we're looking back at Season 8, looking at all our best bits here on Property Matters. Welcome along to the final episode for Season 8. I can hardly believe that this little idea all those years ago has turned into something that's run this long. Very grateful for everybody that keeps on listening, whether you're listening live today on Planet FM 104.6 or streaming it through any of our favourite podcast sites. Thanks for tuning in. And rather than a guest today, we're going to just share a few highlights from the season, but I do have some very special people in the studio with me today. They are the people from behind the scenes that make the show happen each week. We have Monique, who manages all of our bookings of guests to make sure they know where and when to turn up. She also chases me to make sure I've got the questions written each week, because I do require a bit of chasing. We have Stephen here, who looks after our Best Bits episodes like today and replays when we go on a break over the year to make sure that something is going out to air, and he's prepared tonight's show, so thank you, Stephen. We have Olivia from Dunbuy, our fabulous social media company that makes sure each episode is broken down with great quotes and moments and videos that can be turned into social posts all week. And she brought in the video camera this year, which I'm getting used to, but it's been fabulous for our social posts. And Paul, who can't be here today, but he looks after all our pre-show marketing and branding of the show to make sure you guys all tune in. So a big thank you to them. And of course, all the fabulous team here at Planet FM that enables us to make live radio that also then gets turned into a radio quality podcast. Now, well, first of all, well, welcome team. Welcome into the studio. Great to have you here. You can say hello.
Oh, hi everyone.
They're all terrified that I'm going to interview them today, but I am going to ask Stephen a question, because you chose four favourite moments from the season. What made these four moments stand out for you, as it was a very full season, so I bet it was a bit hard to choose?
So the entire season was really good, so it's really hard to choose just four, but I've always loved the finance and investment side of real estate. So I guess that's why one of the episodes stood out to me. And learning about, you know, financial mindset was also really interesting. And the third one will be about, you know, positive working environment, which I think is really important for us to just listen and hear about. And it's always good to support Starship Foundation.
Nice, a good four mates. All right, well, we're going to listen to our first best bit that you picked, which takes us right back to early days in the season, and we had Jamie James from Jamie James Insurance and Tarpley Hewitt from Hewitt Mortgages, our two regular and favourite insurance and mortgage advisors. And as Stephen said, they were very much talking about the current financial situation and also when to use non-bank lenders. Take a listen. We've seen the OCR drop significantly over the year, but some major banks are now sort of nudging their long-term rates back up. For someone refixing this month, is the one-year and wait strategy still a gold standard, or are we back to seeking the security of a three-year term?
It really depends on the client's situation. So we personalise the rates to the client's financial situation. This is really, really important. Someone might look at a one-year rate, but we need to assess their income and make sure they've got some certainty and stability for their overall financial situation, because we've just come off the back of really high interest rates. They were almost 7%, and that was crippling people. And some were having to sell their properties, so we don't want to go down that route again. So it's really important that our clients, when they come to us, we have a look at their overall strategy and make sure that that is fit for purpose.
How often should someone be looking at their current mortgage? Is this like a health check we should do every year, every 2 years?
Generally, we do annual health checks, but in some cases where customers have fixed longer term, we do review them annually, but if they're fixed really well, like on a low interest rate, then generally we won't, you know, and the interest rates in the current market are higher, then we will just have a look and just ask them if there's any financial changes that could potentially adversely impact them. If there's none, then it's just business as usual.
Okay. And with the Reserve Bank easing the loan-to-value ratio restrictions recently, particularly for investors, are you actually seeing the banks loosen the purse strings, or are their internal stress test rates still the biggest hurdle for buyers?
Well, I'm glad you've mentioned that, Stephen, because we've had one of our main banks loosen the purse strings for investors. So they are now allowing up to 85% leveraging. So for property investors, it's 70% for an existing property, so you need a 30% deposit, but now they're saying 15%, which is good, but you do have to meet a specific criteria, so your income has to be, the surplus at the end of the month has to be pretty high.
Okay. With the big banks still being quite conservative, how much activity are you seeing with the non-bank lenders? Is the slightly higher interest rate worth the flexibility for a growing investor?
Yeah, definitely. We are conducting more activity in the non-bank space for our developers, for our property flippers, which is really, really good. So when I first started back in 2020, I wouldn't entertain, you know, the non-banks, but it is a solution. It's a short-term solution for a long-term gain. It makes it so much easier for our property investors to just get in and get out and not have to provide, you know, full financial documents, because that can be quite difficult. Also, for our existing homeowners, it's a solution for, you know, those that get into financial strife. Just to give you an example of a customer, they almost lost their house. They came to me almost last minute. I had a look at their situation and I found a solution at a non-bank.
Right.
And so we were able to consolidate the debt, and it's almost been a year, so the exit strategy was to refinance her back. Her finances are super clean. She has savings. She had spending money. We helped her with her budget, so it's great. So it's been awesome.
Why is it that the non-bank lenders are more flexible?
Well, they have the funding, and they don't, you know, in terms of regulation, some don't have to comply with the CCCFA because they come under trusts or companies, and therefore they don't have to provide their full financials and show the ability to service. Yeah, so they just need to ensure they've got equity in the properties. So yeah, we can leverage.
Nice. Okay. Jamie, your turn. Over to you. You often talk about protecting financial progress. What do you mean by that?
Warren Buffett has a really awesome rule when it comes to investing. Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, see rule number one. And the reason this rule is so important is because, let's say you have $100 and you lose 50%. Now you've got 50. And you gain 50% back. Now you've only got 75. You actually have to double your effort just to get back to where you were before. So, Stephen, I've got a slightly different variation to this. It's rule number one, don't lose progress. And the reason for that is because we've all come from somewhere. Think about 5 years, 10 years, 20 years ago, life may have been quite different to where we are today. But how you got to where you are today cost you your time, hard work, blood, sweat, tears, sacrifice, a lot of effort. So where you are today represents years of progress. And we all have somewhere where we want to go. That's goals, dreams, the life we want to create for our families. So a event, an illness, redundancy, a bad season in business can wipe out years of progress. So the point is, rule number one, don't lose progress, and protecting your health and your income is the easiest way to protect your health and your financial well-being.
So when somebody does take on a large mortgage, what financial risks are people often overlooking and they're not thinking about that progress they've made to get to that point?
Most people insure the house, but they don't insure the person that pays for the house. And the reason this is important to understand is because when you buy a house, the banks typically want you to insure it. Mm. So that gets done pretty much straight away. But the mortgage itself is paid by one thing. You, your income. Mm. Your income pays the mortgage, supports your family, and funds the life you want to live. So I've seen many situations where people have insured their house, insured their car, insured their TV, and then they experience a change in health, a change in financial circumstances, and that's where things get very messy and stressful. So the point is, insuring your house, it's important, but insuring the person that pays for the house is even more important. Mm. That's your safety net that provides you that security and that confidence to keep moving forward no matter what happens.
So talk me through that. If you're insuring yourself, what does that look like? I mean, are we talking purely income protection insurance? How does it work? When does it kick in and when might it not work?
Good question. That's why it depends on you. So when you meet with a financial advisor, what we typically do is we provide financial mapping so that our clients aren't overinsured. They may not need to have their income covered.
Right.
Or they may not need to have it all covered. It just depends on if something happens, what do you actually need in order to get back on your feet and get back to living life again?
Fantastic. Thank you, Tapri and Jamie. Always love their wisdom on the show. And they have been supporters of Property Matters since the very early days. I think they were on one of our very first episodes back in season one. Now, our next choice is Angela Mayer and Rachel Davies, who were authors of the book Money, 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 which is promoted for women and investing, but had some fabulous tips for everybody, and especially, as Stephen said at the beginning, around your financial mindset. See, it's a, you know, a really big concept to talk about. What are some simple sort of observable signs that someone's mindset around money is starting to shift in a healthier direction?
I think my experience of that is that when people get clear about like their ideas about money, or they might have a belief about money, and they'll look at it and be like, oh, that's a bit wonky actually, like, do you really have to work really, really hard for money, or is someone, is a prince actually coming on a white horse to save me? Or like when you surface one of those beliefs and go, well, actually, maybe I'll save myself, or maybe there's lots of different ways to make money, things get simpler and more relaxed, you know. Like, so I think for me, when someone's done lots of money mindset work, they just feel a bit more like toe, like calm. Things are simpler because when people's beliefs line up with who they really are and what they really value, they're sort of in line, rather than they're believing some strange thing their mum told them 50 years ago that isn't really true, and it's sort of clanging around in the background there, making them do weird spending things, and that's sort of got a slightly wobbly feeling. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and you know, there was research done that showed that often people's money mindset, or the way they think about money, was set by about the age of 7. So, as Rach said, you know, so many of us have kind of been ruled by a 7 years old idea of money, rather than actually having the time and space to explore your relationship with money and realize that some of those things may not be true. They, you know, you can, and you can change the story.
You can update and make it match you right now, or, you know, just have a look and see what you want to keep and what you want to change with your beliefs and your ideas. Yeah.
So, Angela, without giving the whole book away, what are a couple of practical tools you walk readers through so they can move from theory into action?
Well, one of them that we've developed is called The Why Behind the Buy.
And so this is a kind of a nice hybrid one, I would say. So this kind of came out of the fact that once you become a little bit more conscious of your spending, you have an opportunity to change that, for example. So I noticed that when I was at work, I would really like to get out of the office. And so I would say, I'm just going to go and get a coffee. And the thing is, I didn't actually really want a coffee. I just wanted to get out of the office. I wanted a change of scene. I wanted to, you know, change up my situation. And the why behind the buy is actually invites you to sort of take stock of how you're feeling before you spend, and then look at what you're spending and what you're spending that on, and then how you felt afterwards. So it's a very simple exercise, but actually you get a lot of information out of it. And then you get a chance to kind of look back over that. It's over a week and go, wow, I noticed that I'm actually not really wanting coffee at all. For example, I just want to get outside. And I can go outside.
Without spending.
Yeah, and I can go for a walk without spending. We also have information in there about, you know, how to start investing, setting up an emergency fund, paying yourself first, you know, some really sort of foundational things that seem like, you know, oh yeah, we've all heard those before, but they really do make a difference.
Yeah, and things like that emergency fund, just to stop you heading into that credit scenario, because we all have the dentist moment or anything that, you know, that crops up and you wish you had that money there that you didn't need to whip out the credit card, that then just adds further to the debt.
And we also talk about, you know, consolidating, you know, that high interest debt. And just, we try and do it in a way that is as judgment-free and as shame-free as possible, you know.
So look, a lot of women carrying debt, sometimes with shame attached, as you mentioned. How do you suggest people approach debt in a way that's constructive rather than paralysing themselves?
For me, you know, there's different kinds of debt. Like, I feel different about my credit card debt to my mortgage or when I had a student loan. So I think, you know, maybe they've got a different quality, but the debt that I feel the most ashamed about is usually my credit card debt, or the stuff where I'm spending money that I haven't got yet and sort of, what's that saying, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I think for me, the best way is to not feel ashamed about it and just to take a deep breath and have a look and be like, well, do I really want to be doing this, or what could I do differently? Maybe I just need to do this right now to get through this tough time, or maybe in 6 months I can review it, or maybe there's a little bit of wiggle room here where I could start to lower that credit card debt and have a bit more space, or I could give up some things, or... So I'd sort of, just judgment-free and calm, and just having a nice, clear look for me is how I like to sort of approach that. Yeah.
We live now in this world of buy now, pay later. Every single thing now that you, even if you're booking a doctor's appointment, it's giving you the option to ask to pay it. How do we sort of protect people from that mindset of, I need it now? Because there was a time when we just couldn't do that.
I think that is where, you know, a lot of this work comes into play, because it's like, once you get clear about what you value, and also you like the why behind the buy, all of those things, like, you, when you are clear about what you want money for and what that means in a bigger way than just, you know, I want to go to the doctor or whatever it might be, and you go, actually, do I want to buy this now? And what is the effect of that on my long-term goals, or on my short-term goals, or on my medium goals? And so it's that real clarity of understanding what money means to you right now. What do you want it to mean, and where do you want to go with it? And I do think we need some system change there, and some legislation, because it is incredibly attractive, and the way that it's set up is, you know, I think it's kind of predatory for a lot of people.
Definitely.
As well.
And we've talked to credit providers on this show, you know, who talk about the impact that that makes on your credit, not in a good way, you know. Look, your book focuses for women, but already I'm hearing so many things that men can grab from this as well. Is this, you know, this,
the husbands and the blokes are going to be stealing their book off.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as I said at the, you know, top of the interview, like, we wrote it because we saw a real need and a real problem that was women retiring into poverty. But we also did a really interesting piece of research as part of this book called Rich in Context, where we looked at the socio-cultural determinants of financial well-being, which sounds quite dry, but it's actually fascinating. Mm-hmm. And what we discovered was that 30% of all of the people that we surveyed, and that was across Australia and New Zealand and all genders, had no financial plan whatsoever, other than winning lotto. And so this is... the way that we think and feel about money is not unique to women, but it is, you know, we have different things that influence us. So I think there's definitely something in it for everybody.
That's
for sure.
A nice segue to my next question, which was, New Zealand has its own particular housing and cost of living story. How do you think the sort of the Kiwi context is shaping a woman's sense on, you know, what's possible financially, or being, I guess, financially free?
I mean, it is really hard at the moment. I think we'd be lying to say that people aren't stressed about money. And I think we do have a lot of policy settings in this country that don't take into account the specific aspects of women's lives and the responsibilities. So, for example, you know, it's only been in the last year that the KiwiSaver settings have changed. And prior to that, you know, KiwiSaver is actually tied to employment, and if you have caregiving responsibilities, you're not able to, you know, you're not getting money into your KiwiSaver, you're not getting that employer contribution. And so our whole system is really set up not to take into account all of this work that is done, that actually is part of the market but is not valued by the market. So I think, you know, understanding that there's a lot that's also going on. It's not just, you know, like, feel better about money and, you know, sort of manifest your way out of it. That's absolutely not what this book and what we're saying. We're saying it's really tricky. We understand that. And system change is really long, hard work, which, you know, we're up for. But it's also being able to give women some agency and some understanding themselves, because you can't budget your way out of poverty in this situation. Yeah.
Fabulous interview, and go and get the book, Money, 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 where all good books are sold. Now, part of our season, we regularly chat to leaders and about leadership, a little bit sort of a different story alongside our investment stories. And this season, we caught up with Paul Scantlebury from Scantlebury Consultants and talked about the difference between co-workers and high-performing teams, and how he gets a room of high senior executives and leaders to commit to behavioural change when he's running a workshop. You talk about turning a group of individuals who just happen to work in the same space into a highly performing team. What is the difference between a group of co-workers and a truly connected team?
That's an interesting one. It's an interesting one because a lot of the time we don't think about ourselves and our teams as being that way. You can look at it and go, oh no, but we're performing really, really well. We get along really, really well. We're all doing our jobs great. We get high performance reviews. The differentiator for me is when you talk to people about their job and you say, hey, what is it that makes your work great? What makes you successful? What makes you want to come back into it? What is the reason that you're a high performer? People who give you two or three things and they're all, I did this, I achieved that target, I made this thing happen. And then people who say, always we have a dial for what we've done, of course, because we are intrinsically that way as human beings. But then the ones who are in teams that are not just individuals working on the same topic are the ones who go, oh, it was great when I helped the team do this, or collectively we did something. And you see those teams go so much further.
Yeah, no, totally agree. But you run workshops or interactive activation sessions, you call them.
Yep.
Executives are notoriously distracted and busy. I know when I'm in meetings, sometimes you're very aware that they've got 10 things happening in their head at once. How do you get a room full of high-powered leaders to just slow down and actually commit not only to your workshop, to behavioural change?
So for me, it's questions. I mean, questions and curious. You'll see the theme that comes across here. Being curious, being empathetic, and being respectful are three characteristics that I think get you a long way in life. With those leaders, I just ask. I have stuff that I can do with them for sure, and I've seen that it works. But if they don't want to be on the journey, they don't want to be on the journey. It's not worth anybody investing that. The way to help them understand that the journey might be worthwhile them going on is to say, so what's important to you? And so often people say, oh, it's results. Cool. What is it? How do you get to those results? You start unpicking the different elements of it, and then you ask, so what's blocking you from achieving those results? What's the most important aspect of your business? Nearly everyone says the people, right? Common answer. When you start digging into why you're not achieving as much as you think you could, people understand that a lot of the time, sometimes it's structural, sometimes, yes, you need good processes and procedures in place. Well, why don't you have them in place then? Mm. Is there resistance? Why is there resistance? So much of it is down to the human element. It's how we show up, and it's how people show up with us. So I get them into the room by saying, I can help you solve. I'm not going to fix your process problem. I'm not going to be able to, I'm not going to tell you how you do your supply chain process improvement, but I am going to tell you how you can get people to want to adapt the change and adopt it. I can help you with how do you get people to feel accountable to the fact that someone else has told them that they need to do a thing for whatever reason. How can I help them feel connected to the outcome and therefore collectively connected to the overall result? And if you want that, cool. I'm here to go on that journey with you, and it's a journey. It's not just one workshop. It's multiples of those, because it's behavioural change and it's mindset change.
I love that you refer to questioning. Right, that people underestimate in all parts of leadership and facilitation the power of good questioning.
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, actually, and obviously, Stephen, you're saying this because one of your jobs here is good questioning.
Good questions.
And you're doing that very well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I trained in a theatre background, but in an applied theatre setting. And when we were facilitating some very tough conversations around child abuse and family neglect up and down the country in an education setting, everything we did was through gentle questioning. Mm. And it created such a safe space for people to just freely talk, because you weren't leading the conversation, you were just giving those things to get it started.
Yeah. And Stephen, those are some really hard topics too.
Oh yeah.
And it's fascinating, and I'm not sure, I hope you share this experience, but when you're able to create those spaces for people to be able to share on those hard topics, not because you made them, but because you just opened the door to allow them to feel comfortable to do it, it's super empowering.
It's creating that space. So how does understanding, I guess, our unique social style change the way we handle difficult conversations in the workplace?
Mm-hmm. See, that's fascinating. I know you've used social styles there, because you know that's one of I'm accredited in, and that I do. So TRACON social styles, and lots of people have done like a DISC, a Myers-Briggs, like one of those personality questionnaire type things. And this is very similar, based on the same psychometrics and the same frameworks. And by the way, I am trained in that one, but I advocate for many of them, because so much of this is about self-awareness. Now, we often go through life, and you know how some people are good, you say, oh, you're a great judge of character, you're really great at these things. What the frameworks of TRACON social styles or DISC or many of the others, what they do is they allow us to be able to, first off, understand ourselves. So very often we're not that self-aware, because we operate internally within ourselves. We only experience the world from within ourselves. We hear all our inner feelings, we understand those thoughts, but those things don't get out. Mm. And TRACON social styles helps us understand how others receive us. So how does Paul come across to Stephen? Now, I might think I'm coming across in a certain way, and you might go, yeah-ish, but actually, Paul, you can be more abrasive than you think you are, you can be more direct than you think you are, or actually you're really quite analytical sometimes, you go back into your shell, and I don't see it, and I can't see it. So what the social styles framework does is it allows us to understand ourselves and how others perceive us, and then how others also are, so their own styles, and how we can then take a bit of a gauge of other social styles, And then how do we use that? How do we adapt ourselves? And it's one of the big things I love about the framework is that it has a versatility element of it. So the style you are is the style you are. That's it. Just no judgment. It is what you are. Versatility tells you how good you are at adapting to others. And if you're not great at it, how you can improve and how you can use that information that if Stephen's a certain style and Paul's a different style, how do we work best together? And again, it comes back to listening and empathy, saying, if I understand how Stephen wants to receive this information I'm trying to give, if I want to influence you to do something, heaven forbid, but if I were to want to influence you to do something like we often do in sales environments, in any relational type jobs, the best way to do it is by giving you information how you want it, not how I want to give that to you. So if I dial to stories, which you may be able to tell I do, but you don't, you dial to data. If I just go about telling you stories, you'll be like, oh, Paul, stop, please. However, I recognize that you want data, and I'm like, okay, I'll lead in with the data. This is the information that you need and how you need it. Then you're playing to the other person's needs, and you both get something out of it. And that's what I like about those frameworks, is if you use them well and effectively, then you can create relational capital by adapting, but not by compromising who you are, but by understanding how others are.
Fantastic. Thank you, Paul. A great interview, and you can look him up at Scantlebury Consulting. And our final best bit, as Stephen said at the beginning, took a little bit of a twist as we caught up with the CEO of the Starship Foundation and found out where do they need support and how can we help them.
So when someone donates, and we'll talk about how they can do that shortly, when somebody donates, can you give us some examples? You've just mentioned a few of tangible ways of where their money goes. So, for example, do you find that X percentage goes on equipment, X on research? Is there family support services? Where do you see that money being spread?
It's look, it is across the board. We look at impact in three key areas. So we look at clinical care, which includes equipment. It includes training for clinicians and doctors and for nurses. Probably around about 55% of our revenue goes to clinical care and whatever sits under that bucket. We fund research, and so at the moment it's probably around about 12 to 15% of our funding goes to research, and that research can be things like specialist fellows who might have a particular subject that they're focused on. It could be a particular research project that somebody is working on to improve a particular area of treatment. And so there's research, and then there's what we call the patient experience. So what programs can be done within the hospital that make the patient journey better for the whānau, better for the child, and brings also an element of well-being and education for the nursing staff in particular who are stewarding those families through the hospital.
Can you give us an example of that, of a patient experience that your funding has helped?
Yes, there is. There's one called Ringer Artify. And Ringer Artify is, if you imagine a hand, five fingers, it's about wrapping support around a whānau. And within the Ringer Artify, there will be a specialist psychologist, a social worker. There may be somebody with language skills. I can't just off the top of my head remember the other two, but the whole thing is that it's initially Ringer Artify was designed for Maori and Pacifica families going through and helping them navigate the hospital, but it's wider. It's any family, and it's just supporting them alongside the medical and sort of scientific care that they get. So it's very much all I can describe it as it wraps around them depending on what their needs are.
Yeah, that's lovely. When you think of those three areas, clinical research and patient experience, is there a particular project that at the moment that you're kind of really excited about putting the funds into?
So as I said, we're coming to the end of the funding around the oncology project, which has been a project of about $6.5 million. And so that we're rounding that off, and that's coming to fruition. We have other projects coming on stream. One of them in the next couple of months we'll be launching, which is NICU. That's the neonatal intensive care unit. And so we are looking at doing a refurbishment of the NICU project. And that's a project that's around about $3.5 million. So we will be looking for funding for that. And that's picking that out. There are numerous projects on the go that we already fund and are looking for funding, but not to that kind of magnitude.
All right. So our listeners now have hopefully got a good sense of the amazing work, not only that Starship does, but that the Foundation does in order to make all this happen. So all our fabulous listeners and business leaders, this is how you can help. And it can be at a business level or even individual. So let's unpack this slowly. If someone listening does want to help, what are just some of the different ways that they can get involved?
Well, there are many ways, actually. So if you are a business, we have businesses who partner with us, and that is at varying levels. You can come in at around about a $10,000 level, and you get certain benefits or access to certain projects that we're working on, through to $50,000 partnerships and five-star partnerships. The five-star partnerships are partnerships that have been with us for, 20-something years, the likes of Barfoot and Thompson or Mercury Energy. Those organisations pay us a partnership fee, but they also rally up their troops to get involved in fundraising, whether it's, running marathons or participating in quiz nights, whatever it is, they get involved. So that's the corporate side of things. We have numerous community events that we run. So earlier this year we ran an event called Kilometres for Kids, and that's an opportunity for people across the country, families, whānau, schools, to get moving and to get sponsorship to ride, cycle, swim, whatever, to raise funds for the Starship Foundation. We do something which we've just closed off for this year called the Big Bake Off, where people can bake and compete against each other to raise money. Then people can do their own fundraising. If you want to go and climb Mount Kilimanjaro because that's a personal objective, but you want to raise money for charity, then you can get your friends and family to help you do that. So we get a lot of really amazing people out there in the community doing their own thing.
And do you have people or tools that can help set that up so people can safely fundraise? Like, we live in this world of give a little and boosted and things like that.
We do. We have a team that run that. They can help individuals set up a Raiserly fundraising page. They get various collateral and material that they might need to promote themselves. The other ways in which we have people fundraising for us is through regular giving. So some people might, but some people may do payroll giving through their own organisations. Some people may just, dedicate a budget each month and just set that to go into the Starship account. We do campaigns. We run a Christmas campaign. We run a tax campaign where people are given opportunities through direct marketing or through any kind of media channel to donate to us.
Just so many fantastic ways that people can support the Starship Foundation. So do head online and support them. And a big thank you to all our guests who played a part in Season 8. We're going to take a little break. We're going to catch up perhaps towards the end of the year post-election, and we'll do a little bit of a wrap and a look back on the year that it's been, and then we'll kick off Season 9 hopefully in early 2027. A big thank you to Barfoot and Thompson for their continued support of the show.
show. Massive thanks to the team here at Planet FM for allowing great live radio to happen and then to be turned into a podcast. Thanks to the team, Paul, Stephen, Monique from Barfoot & Thompson and Olivia from Dunbuy for our fabulous marketing and organising everything each week. To you, our listeners, thanks for supporting another season and listening live or downloading our episodes, which you can continue to do from your favourite podcast sites. I'll look forward to catching you when the summer months come and it's finally warmer. Take care. We'll catch you again soon. If you're driving home, take care on those roads.